It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We tour through a digital museum called Wisconsin 101. It's a statewide public history project using objects from around the state. Think like a soda bottle, a serving dish, a vinyl record, to help tell about the place we call home. Call in with the question. Share what's on your mind. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tom Broman is co-director of Wisconsin 101 and emeritus professor of history of science at UW-Madison. Tom, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. It's really great to join you today. It's great to be inside and join you today.
Yes, I like that distinction, indeed. You say people often don't think of objects as a vehicle for history. Why not?
I think it depends on sort of how you, where you're doing the history. So, for example, when I was in school, we learned history by reading it in books, basically. And the books, at the time, U.S. history was taught with presidents and wars and things like that. It's become much more diverse now, but it's still very text-based. And I think you learn a lot by reading books about history. You're reading stories that are sort of organized for us, but you're not directly experiencing it. Now, museums have been around for a very long time, and museums give you a much better opportunity to directly experience history by seeing objects that are kind of relics from the past. And so we do have chances to experience history through objects, but we often read about it in ways that really is just about sort of telling stories that have nothing to do with the material remnants of the past.
So, I mean, I wonder, does this lens into the past, you know, bringing forth different objects that people have in their lives or in their communities, does that make history feel more alive?
I think it does. And an example is the tendency all of us have to retain heirlooms from our grandparents or even further ancestors further back, where often we carry things around which contain parts of family history that are meaningful to us. And so we do that in terms of the past of our own families, but we can also do it in terms of the ways we look at objects in museums and use those objects as focal points for imagining what lives were like in the past. Objects in museums do that all the time. And they're very good for that because they're kind of the presence of the past, right? Mm-hmm. If you go to the British Museum in London and you look at some ancient Roman coins from Britain when it was occupied by the Romans 2,000 years ago, you're seeing a remnant of that period right before your eyes.
But I think what you're doing here to me, it seems more of like crowdsourcing history. Like you're allowing everyone the ability to be a curator, that you don't have to go to a museum where something is curated. What do you make of that?
Well, that was the intention. One of the intentions of developing the project as we did, when my partner Sarah Thal and I decided to start this project back around 2011, the one aim was to give students a chance to do something more with their history writing than to write a 10-page paper at the end of the semester that they throw out or keep forever, if in the case of some people. We wanted them to feel like it had some public value to what they were doing. So we've used a lot of undergraduates have contributed to this project. But we wanted to give everyone a chance to tell stories that were meaningful in their locality, right? One of the problems that we have is that we since we're situated in Madison, in the history department at UW-Madison, we didn't want to determine what the state's local history should be from there. We wanted to try and encourage more stories coming in from everywhere. And to an extent, that's been partially successful. It's always recruiting people to write for us is always a challenge. But we've had good participation from different parts of the state.
How is the state of Maine, the Maine Memory Network, kind of a role model?
Oh, that was when I was casting around for what a statewide project might look like when we were first starting about this. I found very few statewide historical organizations that had actually attempted to do something similar, that is both local history, but mounted on a statewide basis. About over 20 years ago, the Maine Historical Society, which is actually the Portland Maine Historical Society, because on the East Coast modeled that, the state, what calls itself the State Historical Society, is actually the local society of the town that was settled when during colonial time. So the Maine Historical Society is in Portland, Maine, the Massachusetts Historical Society is in Boston, but it's really about Boston and so on. Anyway, the Maine Historical Society decided they wanted to have a more statewide reach. And one thing they came up with this great idea of trying to engage local communities in writing their own history. And they did it by securing grants from the National Endowment of the Humanities to hire staff people who would go around to different towns and enlist the local high school, the local historical society, and the public library in a collaborative effort to write town history. I found that fascinating and a wonderful idea, to get the town talking about its own history, guided by people who sort of had some experience in getting these local histories written. And the project has been this website called the Maine Memory Network. And over 20 years, it's become kind of big and cluttered. Websites don't age well, and I don't mean that as a criticism, but taking the original stories. Getting the original stories from the Maine Memory Network takes a bit of work, but they're really cool. They're nicely done. They're interesting. They tell a lot of local flavor. I wish we could do something like that, but Wisconsin's a much bigger and different state. Would take a lot more resources to do, but it's a wonderful inspiration of how you can do a statewide local history.
Tom Broman with us, director of a public history project called Wisconsin 101, as we talk about the history of our state through material objects. And you can join in with questions and comments. Maybe you have one, 800-642-1234. Eugene in Viola is here. Eugene, hi.
Good morning, Kate. Got a frog out of my throat. I've got a shoeshine stand. I bought it in 1954 from the local barber shop, so I've had it for almost 70 years. And I started doing Civil War reenactments, and I'm going back on the road again this summer, and I got about four or five events to do in southern Wisconsin. And it isn't me, and it isn't the stand. It's the people that go through and the stories that you've got to tell.
Oh,
And you
you'd.
run into all kinds of. I started out shining shoes for 15 cents. Now I charge $4 for a shoe shine.
A bit of inflation there, Eugene. A shoe shine stand from 1954 in a barber shop, Tom.
I would love to have an object like that. Would be a great thing to write about, as a way of describing the role of barbershops in town life from mid 20th century. That is, sometimes very common objects can give us great local stories if you have ways of situating them in a place, right, in a town where wherever the shoe shine stand was. It doesn't, and it doesn't have to be a unique object. In other words, some of our best objects are kind of common objects, which nevertheless talk about interesting stories in the towns where they lived their working lives.
Professor Emeritus of the History of Science at UW-Madison, Tom Broman with us, co-director of the public history platform called Wisconsin 101. As we discuss objects that draw out Wisconsin's rich history, you can share in the conversation. Call in with a question, add comments at any point, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about a public history project. It is called Wisconsin 101, celebrating, preserving, sharing local history across the state through objects. And we have its co-director of Wisconsin 101, Tom Broman, is an emeritus history of science professor at UW-Madison. Be part of the conversation along the way. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR. wpr.org. So I want to ask about an object that is left out. Why is the Lincoln bed from the Tallman House in Janesville omitted from the platform?
Well, I often use the Lincoln. That's a good question. I often use the Lincoln bed as an example of why some objects don't work on Wisconsin 101. So let me give you a little bit of the background story. In fall of 1859, Abraham Lincoln was running for president, or beginning to run for president, trying to build up his national reputation. And he had given a speech at the state fair in Milwaukee, and he was on his way. His next stop was he went to Beloit to give a talk. And in Beloit, he met the owner of the house, the owner of the Tallman House, William Tallman from Janesville. William Tallman was a lawyer. He had built this nice house in Janesville. He was known as an abolitionist in the community, so he was definitely a supporter of Lincoln as a national figure. And Tallman went down to Beloit and convinced Lincoln to come and spend the night in Janesville and give a talk in Janesville. And Lincoln, because in those days people weren't as tightly scheduled as political figures are today, said sure. So Lincoln goes up to Janesville, he gives a talk, he spends the night at the Tallman House, and then he heads off to Rockford, Illinois, never to return to Wisconsin again. There's no evidence he didn't have a good time at the Tallman House, but anyway, so that if you go to the Rock County Historical Society in Janesville, and that the main facility there is the Tallman House, which was donated to the city as a museum by the family, you can see the bed that Lincoln slept in, and you can walk to the, I've done it, it's, there's the bed. And when you see the bed itself, and this goes back to why we go to museums to look at objects, and the Smithsonian Institution in Washington has a million such objects that have been used by famous people for one thing or another. I think that when you're in the presence of the bed, you're kind of in the presence of Lincoln himself. I don't know if I'd call it an aura, but there's the bed that the man actually slept in, which is one reason you want to go to a museum to see stuff like that. But that kind of effect doesn't work on a website, because all on a website you're seeing is a picture of a bed. And so we decided that those kinds of objects, which are of interest mainly because they're associated with famous people, don't really fit into our website.
Okay.
Unless the object itself has reasons to be of interest for other purposes.
There is the movement for museums to return artifacts taken from other countries, from Native Americans. Talk a little bit about who owns the objects on Wisconsin 101.
Well, that's a complicated question. For us, again, it's not so much an issue, because all we're really working with are photos of the objects, and those are much less contentious than the actual possession of the objects. However, a version of the question comes up for us in who gets to tell the stories about the objects. And one of the things that we would like to have in an ideal world would be several stories about the same object, where you could get different viewpoints about the object from different communities. Mm-hmm. We haven't done that yet because, of course, I have to say our project, the staff, quote unquote, of our project consists of Sarah Thal, my co-director, who's a professor of history, myself, and then two graduate students who work for us. So we don't write these stories. We have to recruit people to write these stories, sometimes undergraduates, sometimes other historians from around the state, or undergraduate students from around the state. So the photos for us are not an issue, but it's definitely contentious to ask questions about who owns objects. And a really good example of that, if I might direct your listeners in this direction, is another inspiration for our project was the British Museum's project, A History of the World in 100 Objects, which was sort of publicized in 2010. There's a podcast series that BBC Four, one of the domestic radio services, put together.
Yes.
And those were written by Neil McGregor, who was the director of the project and director of the British Museum. The podcasts are really interesting. And the first one is especially interesting because it's about a sarcophagus from Egypt. And in that, the director of the British Museum has to address the question of why the British Museum has all this stuff. And it's a really interesting discussion. So it's a big problem that a lot of institutions around the world are dealing with.
Grappling with, yes. Well, turning to the objects on the website again is this photo of the La Crosse Normal School fireplace. Why is this fireplace significant?
Well, I was it, I it's amusing that this was chosen today to talk about a fireplace on the coldest day of the year. The fireplace and the nor it represents a kind of small version, a miniature part of a school that was created in La Crosse, which is a model for a number of other UW campuses that were built in the early 20th century, right? So UW La Crosse began as a normal school. UW Eau Claire began as a normal school. I think Whitewater began as a normal school. I can't remember all of them. And in this case, the fireplace was sort of the centerpiece of a large recreational a kindergarten room, as the photo on the website shows. And what the story talks about is the origins of UW La Crosse as a normal school, kind of kind of how the fireplace was designed. And then it talks about the evolution of the school into a teacher's college, and eventually into one of the Wisconsin State Universities, and eventually then part of the UW system, or as it's now called, the Universities of Wisconsin, a name that I kind of hate. And then, so the story is really uses the fireplace as the focal point for talking about the building that lived these different lives, first as a normal school, then as a teacher's college, and so on.
It's kind of
I'd love
our
to have a
through
contemporary picture.
vehicle, yeah, if you will, to a much larger story about Wisconsin.
Yeah, it is. And Wisconsin was not, I can't remember. Wisconsin was either one of the first states or the first state to come up with normal schools as a way of kind of creating more teachers for rural areas. So there's a good story here. And this isn't the only story about a normal school that became a university. There's another set of stories about the Council Oak Tree at UW Eau Claire, which is part of the university seal. A bench was made out of that tree when it was felled by lightning. And it's another story about how this school evolved from a normal school into a full 4-year university.
Tom Broman with us, co-director of Wisconsin 101, as we talk about a public history project that aims to share Wisconsin's history through material objects. And you can join in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Tom, the site provides teaching tips for using Wisconsin 101 in the classroom. How do you hope teachers use the history of these objects in their curriculum?
There's a number of ways we could do it. It sort of depends on the age group you're talking about. So one thing I'll point out is that before the State Historical Museum closed, for the construction of the new and much larger museum that's going to come, we had objects from the mini tour from that museum that were basically used to demonstrate history. There was a felt beaver hat, and there was a grinding stone used for grinding corn, and so on. And the people who led those tours would take fourth graders around and use these objects again as a way of kind of giving kids a sense of the stuff of history. So we had those pictures on the website, and teachers could use that to sort of help the students recall, and it was a very popular part. What we would like teachers to do now is to have kids bring in objects and write at the level that they're able to, whether fourth graders or middle school students or high school students, to sort of use those objects to teach the history. And we've put up a few lesson plans. Susanna Schuller, the graduate student who's working for us, has written some wonderful lesson plans in collaboration with some teachers that we think could be used to first introduce high school students to the idea of using objects in history, and then sort of as you develop the idea to create small exhibits of local history of their own that would be used to bring objects together and describe them.
You can really feel the humanities come together through the writing and the telling and the history of it all. I really like that approach. Tom Broman with us, co-director of Wisconsin 101, our guide to this statewide collaborative public history project that uses objects as the centerpieces of local histories. And there's space to talk about objects that live and breathe Wisconsin that you know of. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts along the way. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. More to come. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We learn about treasured and quirky historical objects with strong ties to Wisconsin. The public history project called Wisconsin 101 tells the stories of these everyday objects to uncover richer meanings into what Wisconsin is about. Be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. Share your objects. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have UW-Madison historian and co-director of Wisconsin 101, Tom Broman. Let's take a call. Nancy in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. I'm calling because I want people to understand the value of the woman in the pioneer movement west. And, of course, Wisconsin was part of that at one time. I'm calling about the fact that I have two very heavy treadle sewing machines, and I'm telling you they're heavy because the upper part is solid oak, the bottom is wrought iron, and the machine itself is very heavy solid steel. Now, as the movements west became often occurring, many fields of actually not fields, but forests had to be cut down to establish fields which could grow the grain if homesteads were going to be established. And the valuable part of owning these sewing machines was that clothing had to be mended and new clothing made, because the establishment of a homestead made the clothing simply wore out, because the labors of establishing the homestead simply were under such duress.
Nancy, may I ask, are these antique sewing machines in working condition?
One of them is. I can use it, but I'm very inept at it because, of course, your feet have to move at a steady rhythm. But I feel it's important that people know the value of the woman. This was woman's work. She had to knit the gloves and the scarves and the hats for her family. She had to constantly mend clothing, which was being ripped and torn and burnt in the establishment of the homestead. And I feel it's just important that this object, which would have weighed, I can't even imagine how much, but it would have been a very heavy object to put on a Conestoga-type wagon to be dragged by mules.
Carry across, yes. Nancy, thank you so much. Tom, what comes up for you?
I think an object like that would be fascinating to be featured on the website. And there's two... This brings up the question of sort of a division between two parts of the website, because most of our object histories usually are aimed at situating the object in a particular place, right? So those sewing machines, would feature on one part of our website if they could be set to a story about a particular family that lived in one part of the state, sort of give us a sense of locality. However, there's another part of the website called Your Story and Objects, which is kind of more informal. And there one can simply describe, just simply give us a picture of the object and send us a story about what you know about it. Maybe its role in your family's history or in your own life, something like that. But the caller is right. It would be fantastic to have stories about the tools and items used by families when they were first establishing themselves in the state. That those kinds of stories are wonderful for us.
Nancy, thanks for calling in. Tom, one of the reasons you started this project, Wisconsin 101, because you see a decline in history majors. What separates a public history project from other historical projects?
One of the things I think we want to do is to try and Sarah and I have been sort of very conscious about this from the beginning. One of the things we want to do is give the public a sense of why history counts as something we ought to be pursuing. You hear a lot of criticism about higher ed. Why aren't all the kids doing, you know, computer science and technical majors? Why are we still doing humanities? And I think that the way to push back against that kind of talk is to say, look, when we do history, we build our sense of our own identity, both in terms of the things that we share and the things that separate us. And we should be aware of those stories, and we should be communicating those stories, because it leads us to greater understanding. That's what public history should do, is give us a sense of ourselves in the place we live. That's why choosing Wisconsin as the boundary of the project makes sense, because we all are part of Wisconsin.
What do you tell someone who says, you know what, Tom, I can't think of an object that is significant enough or that evokes a sense of history that can really tell a story? What if they just don't see something, that material thing? What do you tell them?
There are two answers to that. One is it takes a little practice to see, even in common objects, things that can be talked about. And again, this goes back to the part of the project called Your Story and Objects. One of the objects on that little site, and we haven't done much with it. We need to get one reason. I'd love to get more people who are listening today to send in objects. I posted on that website a little maple sap spout. It's a spout that's aluminum, a cast aluminum spout that is used for tapping maple trees. And I used it when we owned some property up in southern Juneau County, northwest of Reedsburg in the central part of the state. And it was my first experience tapping maple sugar, maple sap, and then boiling it down for syrup. It was a wonderful experience. I did it for several years before we sold that property. An object like that is about my life in Wisconsin for sure. It has very important personal meaning for me. And if you think about the objects around you and the stories you could tell about those objects, those are just as meaningful as the Lincoln bed, or as meaningful as you know, a Harley Davidson's first two-stroke motorcycle engine, which we also have on the website, right? So they don't have to be objects that led to big things. They can be objects that are meaningful for you if you want to tell the stories about them.
What about people who might have a story to tell in their own lives? It's not a material possession per se.
There are lots of opportunities that local historical societies offer for recording personal histories, for getting involved in writing local histories. We are a little bit limited by the deliberate design we've put on the site to make it about objects. And objects is a pretty broad term, right?
Yeah.
The remnants of the dam that was going to be constructed in the Kickapoo Valley is on our website as well. So we have a flexible idea of object, but there's plenty of opportunities to get involved in local history through your local or county historical society. And I would urge people to do it, because there are lots of ways of doing public history that don't require objects, but nevertheless give you a chance to be part of this kind of community building project.
Tom Broman with us, co-director of the public history project called Wisconsin 101. As we take a look at the history of Wisconsin through objects, you can join in with questions and comments. Objects in your life, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tom, one of the objects listed on the site is James D. Williams' windlass. Why is the windlass important to include, and what is a windlass?
Yeah, this is one that a windlass is essentially a device that is that has a drum standing on two supports, and you attach a rope to the drum, and by turning the drum with a crank, you can raise or lower something from a well, for example. So if you lower a bucket into a well to get water, you crank up the bucket containing water using a windlass. So you have a drum to which a rope is attached. In this case, the windlass belonged to James D. Williams, who was a black man who came into the state while he was enslaved by someone, but he obtained his freedom, and then he set himself up near Ruie, Wisconsin, which is in western Iowa County. I live in Iowa County, so pretty close to where I live. And Williams bought some mining rights, and then he began lead mining using this windlass in western Iowa County. And in the driftless part of the state, in the southwest state, lead mining and then later zinc mining were big business all over the southwest, Mineral Point, Platteville, and so on. This particular story was written by two students of a collaborator of ours, Gene Tesdall, who was a historian at UW-Platteville. So two of his undergrads wrote this story up first for the mining and Rollo Jamieson Museums in Platteville, and then we imported the story onto the website.
Does the windlass then exist at a museum? Where is it now?
Yeah, it's in the mining museum. It's in the museum in Platteville. You can go see it.
It should be.
Exactly. No, that's and actually it's a good idea of the relationship that we can use in publicizing collections of stuff that are in museums, right? So it gives people reason to go to Platteville and go to the museum. It's a good museum. There's lots of interesting stuff in it.
It can kind of whet your appetite for what is out there around Wisconsin and some of these objects that are in collections that you can visit.
Very much so. Very much so.
Tom Broman is co-director of Wisconsin 101 and emeritus professor of history of science at UW-Madison. The project is a statewide collaborative public history project that tells local histories through objects. You can call in with a question. You can add your insights, your own objects. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, our guide to Wisconsin objects that help tell the stories of our state. Tom Broman is here, co-director of Wisconsin 101 and professor emeritus of history of science at UW-Madison. Let's bring in Randy now in Ripon. Randy, hi.
Good morning. This brought to mind a friend of mine. He used to find objects, whether it's on a farm or a junkyard or an old household, And same thing with me. We would find them, and it could just be a part of something or a hole of something. And we would put it on the dining room table, and then we would all kind of take turns kind of trying to figure out what it was, what its function was. It just made a lot of conversation. It was kind of fun to do. And then eventually we would look it up and see what it actually was. But it was just a fun thing to do for us.
Randy, what was one thing that you did find that you figured out what it was?
Oh, God, I don't know. It's been so long since we've done this. I think it was something to do with some type of farm. I think it might have been like what it comes to mind is one of those tracks for hay bales in the old barn loft, the hay loft.
Mm-hmm.
Mechanism for lifting them up and lowering them or whatever. I think that might have been it. You know, these old houses and barns and stuff, I mean, there's just all kinds of neat stuff. So
sure is. Yeah, Randy, thank you. Tom, I think you could start a game about, you know, guess the history of the thing on the table.
I agree completely. Flea markets are great for that, right? Or farm auctions, right? That there are sometimes you go to farm auctions and you find all kinds of stuff, and it's the same thing. What was that used for? And flea markets, you see the same thing. A lot of, especially now, a lot of kids growing up today are not, given the kinds of products we buy, people are not used to taking things apart and fixing them using tools. So a lot of tools that probably someone of my generation will be familiar with are going to become less familiar to kids growing up today. So that game could be played by a lot of people. And again, if you have objects that you think are kind of interesting to you personally, and you have just some kind of Wisconsin connection with them, please send them into your story and objects, because we'd love to post photos of them. It'd be great to have more objects like that.
Let's bring in Sherry now in La Crosse. Sherry, what is your object?
Well, it's kind of inherited a ledger book from a country school in Vernon County. My grandmother taught there, but it actually belonged to her father when he was on, I guess, would be the school board equivalent, from the late 1800s, early 19. I don't even know if it got into the 1900s, but I got a chance to read. It was interesting because, you know, she spent $1.50 on a broom that year and stuff like that. And I did end up donating it to the Historical Society for Vernon County. I kind of wish I had copied some of the papers off, though, because it was kind of interesting read. But it's very delicate, too, so I wanted to make sure it was preserved.
Well, Sherry, thank you for bringing that. A ledger from a Vernon County country school. Tom, what could that help tell in history?
It kind of depends on how it was used, right? It could be used to talk about the kinds of lessons that were offered to students. It could be used to offer testimony about the kinds of expenses the school incurred. The ledgers could be used. I mean, I'm not enough of an expert in how education happened at that level, but again, a ledger would be something fascinating to have for your story and objects. It's because depending on what was in it, you could do all kinds of great things about what education looked like. It goes back to the La Crosse Normal School, right? That at that time in the early 20th century, education was far less structured in the ways we think about it is today. It'd be a great object to have.
Sherry, thank you. Lynn now in Eau Claire. Lynn, hi.
Good morning. I am originally not from Wisconsin, but I do value history. History is an amazing subject. I have family history. I have a Singer sewing machine that was my grandmother's, who would have been 122 this year. And it was a treadle. Then it was electric. That's what I learned on. I can hand sew quicker, but it's how my family grew with technology. Now I've got a couple of, you know, fancy programmable sewing machines. I also have a beaded flapper bag that one of my mother's great aunts used. And I decided early on, because we do learn from history, my family, as of my grandmother's generation, they grew up on a farm in Iowa, 6 children, all college educated. But I decided it would be a good thing to learn everything my great-grandmother knew, just to touch the past.
To touch the past. Yeah. Oh, Lynn, thank you so much. One thing there that to me sounded really intriguing was the beaded flapper bag. Perhaps, I would imagine, Tom, from the 1920s evening bags.
I would think so, yeah. Actually, Lynn, please, if you're at all inclined, please send us a picture of that sewing machine for your story and objects, and just write a paragraph about how your grandmother used it. It'd be great to have it. I want to make another comment about sewing. Like Lynn, I have to admit, I didn't grow up in Wisconsin. I grew up in Northern Illinois. When I was in high school in the 1970s, a lot of the girls in our high school sewed their own clothes. They got Simplicity patterns, and they went to the fabric store and got some fabric and made their own clothes. And that was a kind of, I don't mean to say everyone did, but it was not uncommon to do that. And so between then and now, you've really seen the sort of passing of a knowledge about how to do sewing, I think, that Lynn alludes to.
Well, from sewing to soda cans here, the project has collaborated with WPR's Wisconsin Life. And one story from this collaboration explored the history of Jolly Good soda. And this here is Wisconsin Life contributor Rachel Vasquez.
If you're having trouble remembering Jolly Good, maybe this will ring a bell.
The next time you're in a food store buying cola, root beer, orange, or any flavored soda, take a good look at the price. I mean a really good look. At Jolly Good, we believe in quality, but we also believe in value. We want you to get your money's worth.
Jolly Good was beloved by Midwesterners in its heyday. Greer Foods started the brand in the 1970s in Belgium, Wisconsin. But after decades of filling fridges across the region, competition from the big soda companies edged them out. They sold the last case of Jolly Good in 2007. But then 2013 rolled around, and an uncle and his nephew had an idea.
Okay, Tom, so why is this story a good candidate for Wisconsin 101?
Oh, it's a great story because our best stories are about objects. First of all, the Jolly Good represents a whole lot of experiences that people of my generation had. And it's about a locality. The company was originally in Belgium, but the place where Jolly Good was made is in Random Lake. And for those who don't know the entire geography of the state, we're talking about Sheboygan County, basically to the north, northwest of Sheboygan, right? So in the east central part of the state. Jolly Good was in stores in Northern Illinois when I was a kid. And it's just so much, it's rich with what that meant to the economy of that area. We have a lot of manufactured objects like Jolly Good on it. And I want to say, too, while we're here, I'm so glad you included this because our cooperation and collaboration with Wisconsin Life goes back to when Erica Janik first started Wisconsin Life a number of years back. And it's continued with Maureen McCullum, and we value it so much. There's so much good work that can be done, and so we're deeply appreciative of that.
Well, this has been such a fun tour through objects and through history. Tom, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's been great. I so much appreciate it, Kate.
Tom Broman is co-director of the statewide public history project. It is called Wisconsin 101. Tom is emeritus professor of history of science at UW-Madison. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We meet a prolific children's author in Port Washington who's inspired by the beauty of Lake Michigan. Barbara Josie has written more than 55 books that have been translated into 29 languages. And her new one, it's called Death's Door, True Tales of Tragedy, Mystery, and Bravery from the Great Lakes' Most Dangerous Waters. Call in with a question or comment for the children's author, 800-642-1234, email ideas@wpr.org. Barbara, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Good morning. Your new graphic novel depicts these five true stories of events in Death's Door. And if you know, Death's Door, this passage between the tip of Door County Peninsula and the nearby islands, what do you hope children learn from Death's Door?
Well, I hope they learn that nature is what it is. You don't get to change nature. You need to adapt to it. And I hope they learn that people from long ago aren't so very different from them. I try to relate the situation from people centuries previous to things that kids are feeling and experiencing now, so it doesn't feel so remote.
Why is Death's Door known to be such a dangerous passage?
It's a combination of a lot of different things. Well, Lake Michigan, we have more shipwrecks in Lake Michigan than any of the other Great Lakes. So there's that. I mean, there's a lot of danger on the lake itself. But now the passage has rocks beneath the surface. And of course, the water rises and it lowers. So you really never know where those treacherous areas are. And the wind as well can blow through there like a demon. And that makes that passage really tough.
And in doing your research on Death's Door, you actually went out on a kayak tour so you could get closer to it and experience it yourself. What was that like?
Well, I'm really a landlubber, and I'm a terrible driver, and I'm just as bad in a kayak. So somehow I managed to convince my granddaughter to come with me, and the group moved ahead, and we kind of zigzagged going back and forth with the kayak because we couldn't go straight and we were laughing our heads off. But I was able to see the bones of shipwrecks below the water. And I was able to see the rock wall, the cliff wall that has the pictographs that indigenous people, Potawatomi, painted on there many, many centuries ago, many years ago.
That must have been so moving for you to see that.
It was because I hadn't yet researched it, but when I talked to Dr. Patrick Young, who's an expert in the Potawatomi and the history of this area, and he was hypothesizing, really believing that these pictographs indicated a battle between the god of the water and the god of the sky, and the god of the sky is the Thunderers, and I could remember the shape of one of the in the pictograph looked a great deal like a Thunderer. So that to me felt right. It all settled into place when I heard that explanation.
We're talking about a new children's graphic novel. It's called Death's Door with Port Washington children's author Barbara Josie. And you can join in with your questions and comments along the way. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Barbara, at times Death's Door is a sympathetic character trying to warn people of the potential dangers. Why portray this deadly passage as sympathetic?
Well, he says in the very beginning, I am wind, I am water, I am rock so sharp they can tear a boat apart. I can't help what I am. I am Death's Door. So I thought to myself, how many times do we say, if these walls could talk? You think about your home that may have been owned by somebody else, or maybe even yourself. You think about a bar or a beauty parlor and all the stories that it's heard. And I thought, what if this passage knew those stories, but it is powerless to help, and it would be stoic, I think. I mean, then I tried to imagine what kind of personality it would have, and I thought it would be stoic, but it would have regrets because it would not want to have inflicted pain, but it couldn't help what it is. The message being, it is up to us to understand that the lake or anything like it has dangers inherent with it. And it's up to us to exercise caution and whatever protective measures we can.
When you explain the story of this monster battle at death's door told through Potawatomi families, you correct a narrative about Potawatomi families who crossed death's door somewhere between 1690 and 1763. How is the real story different from the myth?
Well, I guess that we have no proof of any of it. We really don't. If people are guessing. I weighed in on this side of it because it made sense to me. The other part of this, the story that's often told about death's door, which is how Door County got its name, is that there were warring tribes that fooled each other, and one of the tribes caused the other to kind of come to an unsafe place, and many of the warriors drowned. That didn't feel right to me because I thought they were smarter than that. I don't think they would have fallen for that trick. And they were very brave, and they wouldn't have. I mean, some of the stories say that they captured some Potawatomi and tortured them, and they told their that the others were coming. But I don't think that torture would have. Those were very, very brave people, and I don't think torture would have caused them to fess up. So this one, that it be the story that I told, that was Dr. Young's story and corroborated by a couple of papers, it felt right to me. So these the story I told is not warring tribes. It's about a trade party that left and stopped for a lunch on a cliff that was dry, and it was a sunny day, but we know death's door, a storm can come up very, very fast. And that's what happened. A storm came up and they were trapped on this cliff and couldn't leave and couldn't get up the cliff. Dr. Young also described, well, I asked him some questions, you know, and I said, why did they, well, he said they would put offerings of tobacco in the water as they were paddling. And I said, why? And he said, well, as a peace offering to Mishu Pishu, the god of the sea. And then I said, what happens if they don't offer a peace offering? Well, they could be consumed by the water, or there could be a storm between Mishu Pishu and the Thunderers. And that's what he believed that the Potawatomi would have been thinking. When the storm came up, it was a fight between the god of the sea and the god of the sky.
Was it difficult for you to find accurate information about death's door, considering that it is the focus of fables and tales?
It was real tough. It really was. And because I am writing in this case for Wisconsin Historical Society Press, they want everything to be proven as much as possible. They understood this, my interpretation of death's door and the Potawatomi was an interpretation, but there was no proof we could find anywhere that corroborated completely any of the stories. So I really had to dig to find any kind of evidence of the stories. And when you think about newspapers, today's newspapers have a pretty good standard of factual. But earlier newspapers wanted to tell a good story. So you really couldn't even count on that. There were lots of different places where I could find information, and I just dug everywhere.
Barbara Josie is a children's book author in Port Washington. Her new graphic novel for kids is called Death's Door, about dramatic moments in Great Lakes maritime history. Be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. You can share thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with children's book author and Wisconsin native Barbara Josie on crafting stories for young readers. Her new book is called Death's Door. It's about the narrow strip of water on Lake Michigan's shore between the peninsula of Door County and Washington Island, known for shipwrecks and treacherous storms. Call in with a question. Be part of the discussion. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Lisa in Milwaukee is here. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, good morning. I love the title of your book, Now That I Know What You're Talking About. I was thinking you were going to talk about death. But I have a question for you. How are your children getting a hold of your books? Are they online? Are they on Kindle? What are they doing nowadays with books for children?
Thanks, Lisa.
These books are available in paperback only, and we designed it in paperback so the kids could stick it in their backpack because that's what they like to do with books. But you can get them on, of course, Amazon and any local bookstore. And I think they'll be readily available in bookstores.
You know, and more here on your process and in the publishing, you know, more than 55 children's books now over the decades. How do you find an agent, a publisher who really believes in you and trusts your vision? How do you get that toehold?
Well, normally you would go through an agent, and I do have an agent. But in this case, the Historical Society Press had a relationship with the illustrator, Renee Grafe. And so Renee and I put our heads together and came up with this concept. And we went to the press, and they were delighted to have us as part of their team. We love working for the Wisconsin Historical Society Press because they give us a lot of creative freedom, but they are very, very strict about the facts being correct. And they have experts not only on the publishing team in the editorial area and marketing area, but they have people involved in the education for kids. So they understand standards. They suggested that we include a bibliography. I really thought, oh, what kid is going to read a bibliography? But their education experts say kids do. So having people who are very closely connected to the schools is super helpful.
Several of your books, including Death's Door, as you mentioned, are illustrated by Renee Grafe. What is your relationship like with illustrators? What is that collaboration like?
Normally, I don't have a relationship with an illustrator. I'm assigned an illustrator by the publisher. But in the case of Renee, she is really my best friend. And she groans when I call her. I called her yesterday and I said, oh, we're in trouble because my brain has gone AWOL. And when that happens, it usually means it's cooking up a new project. And she is in the process of moving. So she didn't need another new project, and she just groans. We're very, very tight, and we collaborate tightly on everything. So there's no word move that I make without consulting Renee, and there's no illustrative move that she does without consulting me. That said, I'm queen of the words, and she is queen of the illustrations.
You stay in your own lane, so to speak. What is your writing process like once you have a good story idea? What happens?
Well, when I said my brain is AWOL, I feel like when it's cooking up solutions and it's cooking up words and sentences and phrases, there is the narrowest strip of brain left for my day-to-day activity. And I do things like bump into things, and I have trouble sleeping, and I know that my brain is just working. I just let it go. And I recognize now those creative, juicy times when I just have to let it go. I can't push it. I can't try and write. But then I'll wake up and I'll have, as in the case of Death's Door, the very first sentences in the book came to me very quickly. So I just kind of in service to what my brain is cooking up.
Death's Door is your first graphic novel, though. Why publish a graphic novel?
Well, I've always wanted to. A story is a story, whether it's told by a campfire, whether it's read in a novel, whether it's told pictures only. And so you find a new genre. I've done children's theater, I've done musical, I've done music. All of those are ways to tell story. And this was a way I hadn't tried before, graphic novel. And so I thought, what are the differences? How can I use them? And I thought, by using separate panels, all of those make children stop and think. So we have several areas in the book that are many, many panels for a single sentence. And that makes children stop. Mm-hmm. I also use words like listen, look, feel it, think. All of those make the readers stop and assess. What would I do? What's happening here? Notice what's happening. So I tried to use the things that the graphic novel would offer me and use them to my advantage in the story I wanted to tell.
We are talking about the new children's graphic novel, Death's Door, with Port Washington author Barbara Josie. You can call in with your questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Barbara, we heard from Rachel in Redcliffe called in and is wondering if you were able to speak with tribal members about the Potawatomi stories and the legends in your book.
Yes, I did call, and the Historical Society talked to the people at the Potawatomi Center, Library and Cultural Center. And they could not come up with something because this happened so long ago. There just were no records of what happened. So they kind of came up empty. So then that is when I turned to Dr. Young, who brought up letters and journal entries from people who had visited with a Potawatomi that seemed to corroborate the story that he tells.
Your books have been translated into 29 languages, and Ghost
Yes.
Wings was adapted into a bilingual play on the wings of a mariposa. Do you approach stories differently knowing that they could be translated?
Yes, I think this book, Death's Door, would make the most wonderful play, sort of like Our Town. And I started out my writing actually writing neighborhood plays when I was a little girl, and I love theater. So occasionally I'll just come up with a story that I think this is really made for theater, and Death's Door is one. I would love to see this produced.
What were your neighborhood plays about growing up?
Oh, well, I did things like Aladdin's Lamp. And I would take a story that I knew and make it into a play. And of course, we used a bedspread curtain and stuff like that. And we charged the parents who paid for all the things that were in the play. And the other thing that I did was, I had a partner in crime, Mike, who was my best friend at that time. Very creative guy. And he and I cooked up schemes and dreams and charged the little kids money to do all of them. For example, we created The Land of Green Ginger, which was a trail along the woods into the swamp and then onto an island that had a blood bug tree. So we would take the kids and charge them to take a tour. And one of us would be sound effects. So we would hide in the woods and we would make spooky sounds while the other one took the kids on tour. But what that made us do is, in order to get the kids to pay each time, not just once, but more times, we had to change the story. So we were constantly thinking in terms of story. I didn't know that writing was a thing. I just didn't even know it. I didn't have a library in my school, and I didn't have one in my town, Grafton, until I was in probably around seventh grade. So I didn't understand really what fiction books were like. I was in a Catholic school, and all the books were about saints, and they didn't sound like me. So I ended up just creating story constantly in my mind, not knowing that that was kind of a pre-writing exercise.
Barbara Josie is a children's book author in Port Washington. New graphic novel called Death's Door, stories capturing moments in Great Lakes maritime history. Join in the discussion. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What a pleasure to have Wisconsin author Barbara Josie, who has written more than 55 books for children, translated into dozens of languages. Latest one is called Death's Door, featuring two stories about the stretch of water near Lake Michigan's notoriously treacherous western shore. Call in with a question or comments for a children's author, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Alan in Menominee is here. Hi, Alan.
Good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead.
Well, I'm a former scuba diver, and I had one commercial stint help pay my way through college, and I dove on what formerly was the telephone line that connected the mainland with Washington Island, and it went out through a couple other islands to get there. One of them was a small Coast Guard island. And that I can tell you that there are currents in Death's Door. It's like scuba diving in a river, and at that time it was a clear river. We could see 100 feet or more, and the current would change without warning. You might be swimming into the corner, kind of into the current, kind of quartering in it to go to, on a straight angle. And we would follow this cable, which had malfunctioned. It wasn't working anymore. And they were looking. It was the first repair job of a underwater telephone line probably in the world. Hmm. And the current, I was shocked at times swimming how the current would change. And it would even take rocks on the floor of Lake Michigan, whether you were swimming in 90 feet or 100 feet or 80 feet of water through there.
Wow. Alan, thank you for describing what that feels like. Barbara, what comes up for you?
Yeah. Wow. It makes you think about the people who lived on Washington Island or one of the other islands. You know, it isn't just about shipping that took that treacherous passage. Imagine, and this is what I ask children to imagine you're living on the island and you have no connection. I mean, this is a phone line. I don't know when the phones came in, but of course there were centuries where there was no phone line, no access to mail. Nobody could cross what they called the Crystal Bridge. In the wintertime, it's easy enough and, well, difficult, but possible in the summer. But in the winter, it's ice. So do you walk it? And what happens in the spring when the ice is soft? So to be isolated on Washington Island is really, really, it's a little bitty island. And even now, there aren't many people. The graduating classes are maybe four children. So imagine if you lived on one of those remote islands and you had no way to get supplies or communication with anybody on the peninsula. Ellen, that's so dramatic. I'm so glad you told that story.
There's a story about a mail carrier who delivers goods to remote islanders. What is this story in your book?
Oh, I got this story in a crazy place. It was the story of mail carriers of Washington Island. Now, that's kind of an obscure publication, but it had, in the words of the mail carriers, their experiences. There were so many stories. So for a long time, the U.S. Postal Service didn't have a mail carrier. So in the case of Henry Minor, the people on Washington Island asked him, after being isolated for most of the winter, to please pick up the mail and supplies in Sheboygan, or I'm sorry. In Green Bay. He had to go by foot with his sled from between minus 23 degrees and minus 30 degrees, 6 to 7 days on foot over the Crystal Bridge through the snow. And he used his own words to describe that was one of the lucky places where I found, that's a pretty good a resource when you can find it in the words of the person who experienced it. And he had stops along the way that he could make and stay overnight. When he got to Green Bay, he packed the sled, but it was a big blizzard. And everybody said, don't go. But Henry said, well, I'm going to go because I want to make church in time. So he took off minus 30 degrees and had to plow. You know what it's like to go through fresh snow. It's exhausting. And in his words, I know that he was eating fat pork and molasses because he'd learned that that keeps your energy up, taking a sled full of supplies so that the people on Washington Island could get the things they needed and a little bit of news from the newspaper and some letters. So they pitched in and paid him $20 for that trip.
Mm.
It's an amazing trip, and I won't tell how it ends because it's a big surprise, and it shows the character of the people.
But the first cabin he arrives at, when he's so cold and frigid, they weren't welcoming. And you know, that was even hard for me as an adult to accept.
Right.
Yeah.
I know.
How could that be? Yes. Right?
I know. Well, it wasn't the first. He'd gone without incident, except for minus 23 degrees. He got through the first three stops. Then when he got to Green Bay and packed up, now he's headed back in the storm and just, he can't go further. And he describes how he's exhausted and his legs give out. So he falls in the snow. But you know, when you fall in the snow and it gets cold, this feeling comes over you that it's a pleasant thing. And you could just take a little rest, a little snooze, and you'll be all right. And it's a trickery of the cold that numbs you to have that thought. So he knew that he couldn't rest. So he's too tired to go on. So he claws his way through the snow with his mittened hands. Then he sees a cabin ahead and he's excited. Maybe he anticipates a nice dinner and resting by the fire. He gets to the cabin and the men are fighting inside and they won't let him in.
Hmm. Barbara Josie of Port Washington, new novel is Death's Door, a children's graphic novel. You can join in with your questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Joe in Hillsborough is here. Joe, hi.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
So I'm a pilot, and I've flown into Washington Island on numerous occasions. There's a small grass strip there. And one of the things that I love about that area, particularly Washington Island, is as you take off, you're almost immediately over the water. But just off the coast of Washington Island, there are visibly two shipwrecks that are on the bottom of the waters. And I think it's kind of testament as to, you know, how difficult navigation was and the trickery of being in that area on the water.
Wow, Joe, and you can see those shipwrecks visible to the eye from the air.
Yes, it's kind of fun to see them.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for calling in. You know, it reminds me, Barbara, of your story of a character who is a female shipbuilder. And
yes.
You write about how her work goes unrecognized. Can you talk a little bit about the story of shipbuilding in Death's Door?
Well, in this case, this is a ship built by a couple called the Clows. And in those days, of course, I mean, it took a little digging to find out that Sarah Clow was one of the two shipbuilders. She and her husband, David, were the shipbuilders. But she's not mentioned. It's usually David Clow, Captain David Clow, David Clow. But I dug a little bit deeper and found out that there were two people who built the boat. And consider, they were on Chambers Island, two of them. They were the only family on the whole island. Every single thing that was on this schooner was built by hand by these two people. And Sarah also had seven children, and she had to grow the crops. She had to take care of the children in the household, and they were apparently quite a jolly couple. They loved to laugh and really, really loved each other. But in those days, a woman isn't mentioned. Now, one of the things I thought was interesting was I know that they had to use this kind of a saw, which is a log that is suspended on a trestle. And one person stands on top with a saw, and their partner's is on the bottom. So they're going up and down with the saw. But Sarah was on the top because David was quite a large man and he wouldn't have been able to stand on the top. They did everything. They even built the nails called trenails that are pieces of wood. Everything came from that island and they did it themselves, all by themselves.
Can you, what must have been like, and I think there's an illustration of this, but just seeing that boat sail for the first time and seeing all of those years of work coming to fruition.
Yes. And if you read the back matter, it describes what happens to that boat later on. It's stuck. It gets stuck in a swamp because a storm pushes it into a swamp, but David refuses to give up. So he finds a way to dig out of that swamp and get the boat back on course. There was so much pride in that kind of a ship that I can't imagine. And this book, Death's Door, is certainly about a passage. And I love the two men who called in and describing what that passage is like. But more, it's about the people who created the foundation or the bedrock of our state. They're resourceful, brave, sometimes greedy, sometimes heartless. But you read that book and you get a good cross-section or a mosaic of the people who formed the bedrock of our state.
Children's book author and Wisconsin native Barbara Josie, our guide to the craft of writing for young audiences and her latest graphic novel, Death's Door. Call in with the question. Be part of the discussion at any point, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We peek into the creative world of Port Washington children's author Barbara Josie, who finds inspiration in watching the waves on Lake Michigan and walking its shores. Barbara's new graphic novel, Death's Door, depicts dramatic moments from Great Lakes maritime history. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Barbara, a tragic story in the book is about cabin fever, this team of Washington Island basketball players who die crossing the passage in winter. And then a steel-hulled ferry is then built to ensure safer passage. How significant is this ferry?
Well, it's the lifeline for Washington Island. As you read that story, I mean, it's late winter and early spring, which is the most dangerous time. I mean, if it's full out winter, you could probably cross the Crystal Bridge or the ice safely. But when the ice starts to melt, there are slushy spots and you can fall through the ice. But things can drive people out. And one of them to drove people out, off of the island was cabin fever. They wanted to experience something new. And that's one of the places where I relate it to kids. Let's see if I can find that place. It says, oh, now this is 1935, and it's the Washington Island men's basketball team. So we use several little panels to give you the feeling of cabin fever, which I think kids can identify with. Mm-hmm. Feel it. The creepy crawlies, like mosquitoes buzzing under your skin, like you can't stand one more minute on the island, one more minute of cold, one more minute staring at the walls of your room. The islanders call it cabin fever, a kind of winter madness, a hunger for adventure, just as real as the hunger for food. It makes people burst out of their homes, their safe places, for adventure, for fun, for something new. So I describe this familiar feeling to kids and have the islanders, which is what the basketball team was called, leave the island in a group of cars all together, caravan, and get safely to the peninsula. Traveling back, a terrible accident happens, and the men enter death's door. They fall through the ice and enter death's door. That was a huge loss for the island because they're so tight. And as they say in the book, on an island this small, everyone is neighbors and every neighbor is a friend. So there's a big grieving for these men that had to be treated very sensitively because the descendants of these men are still on the island. But you are not going to change that feeling of needing to go out or wanting to go out and get off the island. So what can change? Again, you're not going to change death's door. You're not going to change the passage. You can change the way you cross on the path. Passage. And so the ferry was created that with a front that could break through the ice. And now it's safe to travel on the ferry across death's door. It's we who have to change, not nature.
You mentioned how this is still a sensitive subject on the island, even today. How do you broach that trauma as you write, and talk about the family's descendants?
Well, you have to tell the truth. The men died. But I treated it in, I think, a pretty sensitive way. I'll find that place. Okay. But they never make it home. A search party spies their tire tracks and follows them to a hole in the ice. All six men have entered death's door. On tiny Washington Island, everyone is a neighbor and every neighbor is a friend. The loss of even one is a loss for all. Listen. Whoosh. This is the sound of the island crying, the people and the trees and the beasts all mourning for the friends they lost. Whoosh. That is the howl of my wind, for I am crying too. So to show mourning, to show feelings of this passage that couldn't help what it is, that was my way to handle this and let the islanders know that it was a tender thing to have lost these friends and neighbors. But it is also the truth. That's what happened. So that's mm-hmm. the way I treated it.
You walk along Lake Michigan nearly every day and your windows look out to the lake. You write about the lake. You embrace it. What should people know about Lake Michigan?
It's the most exciting place I can imagine. I can't imagine ever not living beside it anymore. And it has so many moods. Every single day is different. But you cannot take it for granted. It has dangers to it. And when the weather says gale warning, when it's hazardous to go out into the water, you should not. I have a brother who's a crazy guy, and he fights wind and water, or he says he plays with it every day, almost every day. He does almost all of the wind water things there are to do. But he's very respectful of what the lake is and what it will do. And he takes precautions for that reason. He doesn't stop playing with the lake, but he's careful about it. And you have to be. There are too many deaths. Oh, I've also created a shipwreck walking tour along Lake Michigan because the stories are so dramatic. So it's an app-based program. You start at the light station,
mm-hmm.
and you download it to your phone. And my crazy brother and I, Don and I, are the voices on the tour. And I take you through a number of shipwrecks along Port Washington's coast in dramatic way. It's sort of like a radio play with sound effects, fog horns and things like that.
Maybe harkens back to your youth just a tiny bit.
Yeah, right?
Right. Do you consider your stories a form of conservation for Lake Michigan?
Yes.
and natural waters?
Absolutely. I feel so strongly. It's such a beautiful, mysterious, it is like a person to me. I'm imagining another story that I want to write. This would be a novel, a kid's novel, about one of the shipwrecks that happened right outside of the very center of Port Washington. And I think I'm going to call it Frozen Charlotte is the name, working title that I have for it. So the lake, it never stops surprising me. Oh, I have to say this. I was walking, this was a couple weeks ago, and I got to the bird sanctuary and I looked down at our south beach and I was with my friend Mary, my walking partner, and I said, "What's that?" I couldn't recognize what it was, so I took my phone and I enlarged the lens, took a picture, and then enlarged the picture, and I said, "I think they're flamingos." We got down to, and that's what they were.
Indeed.
I don't think anyone had seen them at that point. There were three people on the beach. Yeah. Two women were reading and weren't looking up, and one little child was digging in the sand. So I think they maybe just landed.
And lo and behold, those news reports, you never know. Well, Barbara,
never know.
What a pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Barbara Josie of Port Washington is the author of more than 55 children's books. Her new one, it's called Death's Door, True Tales of Tragedy, Mystery, and Bravery from the Great Lakes' Most Dangerous Waters. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.